Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's ACLU briefing. I'm AJ Hikes. I use they/them pronouns, and I'm the Deputy Executive Director for Strategy and Culture at the ACLU, and I'll be your moderator today. It's an honor to be in conversation with you all, especially at this critical time. As you know, we are here to discuss the Supreme Court. Last week, the court ended its term with a historic decision about presidential immunity, but that was far from the only case of consequence. The court also handed down major rulings on reproductive freedom, voting rights, free speech, and more. With the term now over, we wanted to come together as a community to talk about what lies ahead. And so we're going to get into all of it. Over the next hour, we'll hear from our ACLU experts about what the Supreme Court's decisions mean for our rights and liberties, the path forward, and of course, how you, our amazing supporters, can help. And stay tuned because we actually have a very special message from Academy Award-winning actor Ariana DeBose, who is the ACLU's Artist Ambassador for Voting Rights. So for today's discussion, I've asked three of my esteemed colleagues to join me. I'm grateful to have David Cole, Louise Melling, and Cecilia Wong with us. They work across the ACLU's legal departments and fight around the clock to protect our civil rights and civil liberties. Thank you all so much for being here. We have a lot to cover today, so we're going to dive right in. I first want to bring in David Cole to talk about the presidential immunity decision. As the ACLU's legal director and a constitutional law expert who has argued before the justices many times, David has a deep knowledge of this court. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Thank you, AJ. So yeah, we're going
Let
to
me
start.
just
Oh,
let
go
me
ahead.
go ahead and get us started. There is so much that has happened in this SCOTUS term. It can be hard to wrap our minds around all the decisions and what they mean for the future of our country. But let's start with the decision that is at the top of everyone's minds. Can you break down last week's decision in Trump v. United States on presidential immunity? The court tried to cast its decision as constrained. Is that how you would characterize it?
Not exactly. Before last week, everybody assumed, and when I say before last week, for the past 200 plus years, everybody assumed that presidents, if they committed crimes while in office, could be prosecuted after they left office, that they were not above the law, that all persons are equal before the law in this country. Trump's lawyers themselves argued in his impeachment trial that the Senate should not impeach him because he could be held responsible after the fact for any crimes that he committed with respect to January 6th with a criminal prosecution. There is no support in the Constitution for the notion that the president is immune after he leaves office. There is support for congressional members having immunity for things they say on the floor of Congress, but no immunity provided by the text of the Constitution to those who serve as president. No original understanding supports that. Indeed, we had just gotten rid of a king, and we wanted a president, not a king, someone who was subject to the law. The executive branch had long taken the position that while presidents couldn't be prosecuted while they were in office, because you can't let a jury of 12 remove a president from office. There's another process for that, impeachment. They always said once the president leaves office, he is subject to that kind of accountability. So the Supreme Court, dividing 6-3 along partisan lines, created a brand new immunity for the president, not founded in the Constitution, not founded in its text, not founded in the original understanding, and that will cloak presidents, including former President Trump, from criminal prosecution, so long as they use anything within the outer perimeter of their official powers. And that is a very, very broad, they define that very, very broadly. So it's going to be very difficult for prosecution of President Trump to go forward. He can be prosecuted for purely private acts, the court said, but even Trump conceded that. And notwithstanding his concessions, the court would not say which of former President Trump's acts were private and therefore could be prosecuted, and essentially gave him a blank check. The justification they gave for that was, we're concerned that if presidents can be prosecuted after the fact for things they do with their official power while in office, they will be timid. They will be overly timid. They won't be able to, serve in the way, in the vigorous and a way that we want them to serve. The problem with that argument is that for 200 years, every president since George Washington has assumed that they could be prosecuted, that they were not above the law. And I don't think, you know, you can say a lot about American history, but I don't think American history supports the notion that American presidents have been too timid out of fear of this sort of criminal prosecution. So a very, very disturbing result from, again, from a 6-3 Republican majority court.
Absolutely, David. And I think just to underscore how dangerous of a precedent this is setting, we know that the end of Justice Sotomayor's dissent ended with, "We fear for our democracy, I dissent." Can you talk a little bit about the dangerous precedent that's set here around essentially just placing presidents above criminal law?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, fear for our democracy, because the core principle of democracy is that we are all equal before the law. We all stand before the law, and especially the criminal law. No one is free to violate criminal law with impunity. And yet the Supreme Court has now said one person is, and that person is the president. So take Trump himself. Should he win re-election, he's already made clear that he intends to use his office to wreak revenge by going after his enemies, probably starting with President Biden. And President Biden will be protected by the court's immunity, but anyone else he goes after would have no protection. And even if it was clear that President Trump's efforts to go after these officials, his enemies, were totally unjustified, driven by vengeance, not by serving the public good, engaged in for fraudulent purposes, even if they were engaged in to line his own pockets, he could not be prosecuted after the fact. He would not be, could not be held accountable through criminal prosecution after he leaves office. That really opens the door to a lot of very problematic wrongdoing by presidents who have are willing to do that, and we know there's one president who's very willing to do that, and he's running for re-election again.
So, David, this is just really an outrageous decision, and it sets a terrifying, dangerous precedent. I'm going to ask you a question that I know a lot of other folks have on their minds. Now that this is on the books, what, if any, recourse do we have to hold the president accountable for their actions? And I know it's something we're asking at the ACLU, because that's something that we are in the business of, is holding the president accountable for their actions. So what's the recourse now?
So, you know, changing this decision would require a constitutional amendment, which may well be justified. But I think that the most important sort of takeaway is that we can't hold presidents accountable after they leave office. We better hold them accountable when they're in office. And so, you know, we can sue them. We sued, we filed over 400 legal actions against the Trump administration last time around. Very important to challenge their actions while they're in office, both through litigation, through the news media, if their actions are sufficiently grave, through impeachment. That remains an option. So it's not that there are no checks available for presidents who abuse their office. What this decision does is take criminal prosecution off the table for the very worst abuses, criminal abuses. But I think that only underscores the importance of the kind of work that the ACLU has long done, which is to hold presidents accountable while they're in office, and join them from taking illegal actions before they take them, or shortly thereafter, because that's really the only option we have.
Thank you so much for that, David. I'm going to underscore a little bit of what you just shared. So as we've said several times here, this decision sets a dangerous precedent, but we cannot let this ruling stand. So we are calling on Congress to pass a constitutional amendment overturning it. And we know that inaction from Congress or the people at this moment is completely unacceptable. So if our representatives cannot act now, when the court has just presented our democracy with an immediate existential threat, then they can't legislate at all. That's just the truth of the matter. So we're going to ask you to join us in urging Congress to pass a constitutional amendment restoring presidential liability, because those who criminally abuse the office must be held accountable. We elect presidents, not kings. That's what we do. We elect presidents, not kings. And so we're going to invite you to take action at aclu.org/no kings. I love that. aclu.org/no kings. And thank you for the reminder again, David, that at the ACLU will continue doing what it has always done, and that is still holding presidents accountable. I say all the time, no matter what political party you're affiliated with, you can get this work from the ACLU. So thank you for breaking down the presidential immunity case and the pathways that are still available to us, David. Before we turn to some of the other major decisions of the term, I would love to know if you have any top line reflections on the justices and the term that you'd like to share with us, because it's really difficult to process all of it. So give us some of your top line takeaways.
Yeah, so this was a big term, a very big term. And I think one way of looking at what the court did this term was that it extended brand new rights that it made up out of whole cloth to hedge fund managers, big business, and former President Trump. At the same time, it denied constitutional protection to Black voters in South Carolina, to homeless people arrested for sleeping in public, and to a US citizen who is being barred from living with her husband and the father of her child because he was denied a visa from abroad. He's an immigrant. Without any explanation whatsoever. So the court this term, and all those decisions, by the way, were 6-3. The court in its most consequential decisions divided 6-3. I said at the beginning of this term would tell us, is this a 3-3-3 court with Kavanaugh, Roberts, and Barrett sort of in the middle there, or is it a 6-3 court? In the big cases, this was a 6-3 court. Very disturbing. The court's purpose in our democracy is to protect those who can't protect themselves through the political process. The court flipped that script and essentially protected the powerful while denying constitutional protections to the most vulnerable among us. Now, I will say it was a somewhat mixed bag, and we'll get into this, but somewhat mixed bag on civil rights and civil liberties. We filed briefs in, I think, 16 cases this term that led to a decision. In 11 of those cases, the court ruled on our side, and in only 5 did it rule against us. So, you know, we can still win before this court in the First Amendment area, which we'll talk about later. In particular, the court has been very strong in protecting First Amendment rights. But again, in the most consequential decisions, the court divided on this, you know, very partisan lines. And most disturbingly, I think, in the Trump immunity decision, where, you know, ordinarily in those kinds of big political cases, the court tries to rise above partisan politics, reach some kind of a compromise so that they can issue a more unified decision. But no, they gave Trump everything he asked for effectively. And so it was 6-3.
Thank you so much for giving us your thoughts and providing that context for what's to come, David. So for all of you watching, as David said, the ACLU is not gonna be stopping fighting to protect our rights and our liberties. We'll remind you all, we are 104 years and counting into this work, and we ain't stopping anytime soon. You can definitely count on that. And so I appreciate the reminder that it was a mixed bag. David is our kind of resident optimist at the organization. It reminds us that we can still win at the courts. We absolutely can. But also making the fine point that we did have some big consequential losses that we all need to be very concerned about moving forward. So now let's turn to some of the other major decisions this term. First up are the two highly anticipated cases heard by the court this term involving abortion. One about access to emergency abortion care, and the other about access to mifepristone, which is a medication that's used in most abortions. To break down the court's decisions, I'm going to bring my good friend Louise Melling into this conversation. Louise is one of our deputy legal directors at the ACLU. Thanks so much for being here, Louise.
Thanks, AJ.
So first, can you explain the emergency abortion care case, Will versus the U.S.?
Sure. So this is a case where the U.S. government brought suit arguing that Idaho's law, which bans abortions in all cases unless they were life-saving, violates a federal law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And the government argued that that state law violated the EMTALA, that's what the emergency law is called, by prohibiting emergency room doctors from providing an abortion where that was necessary to stabilize an emergency medical condition that would otherwise threaten serious harm to the pregnant woman's. In other words, the state law was going to ban abortions in the ER that were necessary to preserve a pregnant woman's health. The federal district court agreed with the United States and it issued an injunction. It ruled that the federal law overrides the state ban in these emergency conditions. The Supreme Court stayed that ruling, meaning Idaho's law could go into effect, and it took up the case even before the Court of Appeals had addressed it. We filed an amicus brief in that case, the court heard arguments, and then the court. What the court did was it didn't address the merits. The court dismissed the case as, legal term, improvidently granted, meaning the court says, oh, we shouldn't decide this now. We shouldn't have taken it up at this point. So that was the ruling. And then there were, this is a 3-3-3. Justices Alito, Thomas Gorsuch wrote to say that they would have ruled that nothing in the federal law would prevent a state from forcing hospitals to deny emergency care to seriously ill pregnant women. Justices Kagan, Sotomayor, Jackson would have ruled the opposite. And as to Justices Barrett, Roberts, Kavanaugh, well, they punted. They said the party's positions have changed since the court took up the case, so it should go back to the lower court to decide. Most importantly, though, what those three did was they voted with the three liberals to lift that stay so that the injunction went back into effect. And for now, in Idaho, the state can't prevent hospital doctors from providing, emergency abortions. So lots of people breathe a sigh of relief. Just want to say two things about that. One is, it's not over. This case is back in the district court. And there's another case out there involving Texas and the US government, the petition before the United States Supreme Court still sitting there. So the merits are yet to be decided. But here's the core. The United States Supreme Court had the opportunity to hold once and for all that every pregnant person has the basic right to emergency medical care when they need an abortion to protect their health or lives. And the court had a compelling reason to do so. While the court's stay of the Idaho law was in effect, patients in Idaho had to be airlifted out of the state for care on the order of one a week. So even in the face of this, the court failed to act.
Airlifted out of the state just to get care. All right, Louise, we're going to come back to this, but I'm going to turn us to the medication abortion case, Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, the FDA. Can you share the court's ruling in that case and what it means for abortion access across the country?
Sure, the pattern's a little bit similar to the case we just discussed, but this is a case where doctors and several anti-abortion medical associations filed suit arguing that the FDA's approval of a medication called mifepristone. Mifepristone is a drug that's been used safely now for 24 years for medication abortion. Court, the plaintiff said FDA erred in approval, and it said that the decision of the FDA in later years to lift several restrictions on it, including a requirement that it be dispensed only in person, were impermissible. Obviously, this case presents a significant threat to abortion access because medication abortions are now nearly two-thirds of all abortions performed in this country. And nearly one in five abortions are provided by telemedicine, meaning that you don't have to go in to just pick up the pill. Again, the court did not address the merits. Instead, in this case, what the court did was unanimously rule that the plaintiffs didn't have standing. Standing is a doctrine that defines who can bring a claim in court. In essence, it's a rule that says you have to have a concrete injury caused by a law. And so it's a way to ensure that we can't all just go into court to challenge a law that we don't like. That's more for the political sphere. These plaintiffs, they didn't prescribe mifepristone. They had no connection to the FDA's regulation, but they said they were injured because somebody sometime might come to see them after they had took mifepristone and they would need to complete the abortion. It was just too far. It was just too remote, and the court recognized that. But here's what's significant about that case. Again, court did not address the merits, and the court ruled only that these plaintiffs don't have standing. It didn't say others couldn't come in and challenge the FDA's decision. What it also didn't say and point out was that, in fact, in this case, back in the district court, the district judge has let three states, Idaho, Missouri, and Kansas, join the challenge. So this isn't over. ACLU has been very active in this space. We continue to be. We filed an amicus brief in the case. And in fact, it was our case back in the time of COVID that led to the lifting of the in-person requirement. And as you can guess, we'll continue to fight to keep medication and abortion available.
Thank you so much, Louise. So in both of these rulings, the court punted, left the door open for other challenges. So the threats to abortion care remain. In light of all of this, what are the next steps in our fight to protect abortion care and reproductive rights? Because as you said, we're very active in this space. We're not going anywhere. So what's next?
We are so not going anywhere. I think what these cases really make clear is what many of us have all always known, which is reversing Roe was never the end goal here. There's a lot more on the other side's agenda. And there's a lot on our agenda too. We want to protect abortion. We want to ensure access for abortion for everybody. And we want to protect also the right for people to have and raise children. And as to abortion, I'll just say we are on it. We just joined with eight other reproductive rights, health, and justice groups to launch a $100 million campaign, Abortion Access Now, to expand abortion access, including to ensure federal right to abortion. We know that when abortion is on the ballot, it wins. We saw that since Dobbs in Vermont, California, Michigan, Ohio, places that are deep red like Kansas and Kentucky. And in November, there are, I think, 11 measures to protect and expand abortion on the ballot or maybe on the ballot. And the ACLU, through our national office and through our affiliates, we're hard at work already, leading or supporting campaigns in eight of these states. We're busy also. We're going to plan to educate voters in select races in targeted states on critical state Supreme Court races and legislative races. As an organization, we do not endorse candidates, but we think it's critical that people know where each candidate stands on such an abortion issue. And of course, I'm here from the legal department, and we will continue to litigate to increase access. When states pass ballot measures and amend their constitutions, like the states I just referenced, we go in to use those amendments to secure the rights and access. So we've challenged medication abortion we have challenged the bans on Medicaid coverage for abortion in two states under those measures. We've challenged other restrictions. We have litigation against two states that are trying to make it harder for people to go out of states for abortion. We are getting ready in the event that there's a Trump administration and they try to use this old law, Comstock Act, a law from the 1850s adopted to address obscenity. Trump administration, we fear, may want to use that to ban abortion throughout the country, and we'll go to court to stop that. And if there's a Trump administration and it tries to withdraw mifepristone from the market or to impose more restrictions that aren't supported by science, we will be on it and we will see them in court. And if prosecutors come after those who provide, who assist, who have abortions, we are at the ready with an abortion criminal defense initiative, with criminal defense lawyers ready to step in to defend. And you know, one of the reasons I've always been here, we have the power of our members, our supporters, our affiliates, our multi-issue, our different tools of advocacy, litigation, and communications. And we have you. We have all of you ready to use it to advance a right that's so essential to our lives.
Oh, thank you, Louise. Oh my gosh, even in light of all of it, you're just so ready. You don't have to get ready, you stay ready. So to all of you watching, the bottom line here is that these decisions do make our work to protect and restore our reproductive rights even more important and essential. But you heard Louise, right? We're not going anywhere. We are doubling down. 104 years in this. We are not new to this. We're true to this. So the ACLU is committed to stopping this assault on reproductive freedom, and we will not quit until all of us have the right to control our reproductive lives, period. You heard Louise. We're going to see you in court each and every time. So please keep up the fight, y'all. We are in this together. All right. I am going to transition us to voting rights now, because that is another crucial case that we have from this term. I'm going to bring in Cecilia Wong to talk about our Supreme Court redistricting case out of South Carolina. And Cecilia is one of our deputy legal directors of ACLU. Thanks so much for joining us here today, Cecilia.
Thank you, AJ. Good to be with you.
All right, so let me make sure I have this one right, Cecilia, and you will certainly please correct me if I don't. So in a 6-3 vote, the Supreme Court reversed a unanimous decision from a federal trial court, which had ruled that a congressional district in South Carolina was an unconstitutional gerrymander. So they reversed that unanimous decision. Cecilia, can you tell us more about this case and what the decision means specifically for Black voters?
Absolutely, AJ. So the case is Alexander versus South Carolina Conference of the NAACP. And the bottom line is that Alexander is a real setback for Black voters in South Carolina. And more broadly, the decision makes it far more difficult for Black voters and other voters of color to challenge racial gerrymandering in places where there is strong racially polarized voting. So in other words, in states where minority voters tend to vote for one party and white voters tend to vote for the other party. Very hard now under this decision from Justice Alito for plaintiffs to challenge those redistricting maps. So in this case, let me tell you how it came about. We represent the South Carolina chapter of the NAACP, as well as an individual Black voter, Mr. Taiwan Scott, in this constitutional challenge to the new congressional districting map that happened after the 2020 census. After an 8-day trial where there were 42 witnesses and 652 trial exhibits, as you said, the 3-judge district court unanimously ruled for us, finding that the state legislature had race predominated in their effort to draw these new congressional maps. What happened was the 2020 census data showed that because of population shifts in South Carolina, there were 2 adjacent congressional districts, number 1 and number 6. Congressional District 1 was overpopulated now in 2020 by about 88,000 people, and the adjacent District 6 was underpopulated by about the same amount of people, 85,000. So to address that and make all the districts have roughly the same number of people, the state legislature could have simply figured out a way to move about 85,000 people or so from CD6, Congressional District 6, to CD1. But instead, the legislature moved 53,000 people into the overpopulated District 1, and then moved another 140,000 people out of CD1. Why did they do that? The evidence at trial showed clearly that the legislature wanted to hold the Black voting age population of CD1 under 17%. It was crystal clear that they had that target in mind. The state legislature's map drawer, who was an expert witness for the state, testified that he set up the computer software that they were using to draw these maps so that as a legislature move those lines to look at different ways they could draw the map, you could see the percentage Black voting age population change up and down. He also admitted that the new map that they drew created a, quote, tremendous racial disparity compared to the old map. And the district court concluded, based on that evidence and voluminous other evidence, that the legislature was playing the shell game, moving Black voters in and out of these districts in order to maintain that racial target of 17%. As you said, the Supreme Court reversed the district court by a 6-3 vote. This is one of those really deeply problematic 6-3 decisions that David talked about this term. And why did they do that? The court, the majority of the court, accepted the state legislature's defense, which they raised only after we finished putting on all our evidence at trial, that the legislature said, hey, we weren't trying to do this for racial reasons. We were trying to do this to maintain a Republican tilt in CD1. And despite the district court making the finding that that was not credible, the Supreme Court really bent over backwards and decided to reverse the court. Alito really did an appalling thing here. He did a couple of appalling things here. He turned his dissenting opinion from a case 7 years ago called Cooper into a majority decision here without grappling with the abandonment of precedent. And he made it harder for minority voters to bring these racial gerrymandering cases in two ways. First, he said courts are going to presume good faith on the part of the legislature when applying the equal protection test. And secondly, for the first time, and contrary to this decision 7 years ago in Cooper, Justice Alito said for this new majority that plaintiffs basically have to come up with an alternative map that would show that the legislature's asserted political interests could be achieved with less racial impact. And as Justice Kagan pointed out in dissent, that is a completely contrary to previous precedent and ignores the fact that plaintiffs might have proved their case of a racial gerrymander with overwhelming evidence. And yet the court here says you have to come up with this one particular piece of evidence.
Cecilia, this is just egregious on so many levels. You just kept going to another level of egregious and then another level of, my goodness, like in the face of such a clear, as you said, tremendous racial disparity, to have this court still reverse a unanimous decision and then the requirement of the plaintiffs having to come up with an alternative map, it just, again, another level and then another level and then another level of egregious. I think what I'm also just grappling with is that last year we just celebrated a historic win for maps in Alabama. And then this year we face this loss, egregious loss, in South Carolina. So how do we square those two things? And perhaps most importantly, what's our path forward for representative maps and election protection?
Sure. So the quick answer to your question is that these two cases, the Alabama case last term and Milligan, and this year's South Carolina case in Alexander, are about different legal claims. Milligan, the Alabama case, was a claim that we brought under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So it's a statutory claim. And this case this year was a constitutional claim. Here's an interesting dynamic to consider. Normally or historically, these constitutional racial gerrymandering claims have been brought by white voters who are challenging maps that state legislatures drew to take away a vote dilution problem in order to comply with the Voting Rights Act. So that's an important note because the majority of the cases we bring to challenge the dilution of Black or other voters of color, their voting power, are brought under that statute, the Voting Rights Act. So we want to be clear, this is certainly a setback on voting rights, but it is limited to those constitutional claims. I would say a couple things in terms of the path forward. The first is that Alexander, as I said, was a case where Justice Alito, who had dissented just 7 years ago on a similar case, now is part of the 6-3 majority that has ruled against minority voters and really set back the cause of racial equality equality of opportunity in the political process. There's obviously a pattern of this. Shelby County versus Holder, which is the 2013 case that struck down the pre-clearance provisions, sections 5 of the Voting Rights Act, was one of the first salvos where a conservative majority was able to turn back the clock on civil rights in the South and in other states with a history of suppression of minority voters. In 2021, a case called Brnovich, Justice Alito again in a 6-3 opinion with the same lineup with just Justice Breyer instead of Justice Jackson in the dissent, upheld Arizona state laws that had a disparate impact on minority voters and particularly Native American voters in the state of Arizona. Again, changed the law to make it much harder for minority voters to challenge these voting practices. Despite that, though, AJ, I want to be really clear that there is a path forward and that we are walking that path now. As you said, last term we won our Alabama congressional redistricting case in the Milligan decision. And I want to give you a tally of some of the progress that we've been able to make bringing those Voting Rights Act cases under Section 2. We've not only won in Alabama, but also in the South Carolina state legislature, where we've got a net gain of 2 Black opportunity districts, thanks to our litigation with our partners. In the Georgia state legislature, we've won a net gain of 5 Black majority seats, districts. In the Louisiana state legislature, we've got a net gain of 9 majority Black districts. In the Louisiana congressional map, we've got a net gain of 1 Black majority district, including, thanks to a recent stay, we won in the Supreme Court in our case where we intervened to defend a new congressional map against white voters' challenges. We've got now 2 majority Black congressional districts that will be in place for this November's election in the state of Louisiana. And most recently, just this week in Mississippi, or last week in Mississippi, we won a challenge to state legislative maps on a vote dilution claim under Section 2, with a net gain of 2 Black majority districts in the state Senate and 1 in the state House. So there is a path forward. We've been walking that path with our partners and with Black voters and other voters of color around the country.
Thank you so much, Cecilia. I appreciate that you came forward with the stats. You said, you know what? We're still winning. We're not going to let
the stats for you.
we need the good stats too. We need those. And thank you for reminding us that there's a path forward. I have heard you say many times before that no win or loss is ever permanent. And you remind us that we have to remain vigilant, right? And so it's going to take all of us to defend our rights and our democracy, especially leading up to Election Day and certainly beyond. So thank you for those reminders. I want to share one way that everyone watching can do exactly that. And we now have that special video message that I was talking about before from ACLU's Artist Ambassador for Voting Rights, Ariana DeBose.
Hey, y'all. I'm Ariana DeBose, your ACLU ambassador for voting rights. Now, like so many of you, I am deeply concerned about the relentless attacks on our civil liberties. As a mixed race, Afro-Latin queer female artist from North Carolina, now living in New York City, how could I not be? Now, no matter how a citizen identifies, protecting our rights from voting to access to abortion care is essential to upholding the values of liberty and equality enshrined in our Constitution. With so many of our fundamental freedoms at stake, it is more critical than ever to unite, to make sure our voices are heard. Through collective engagement, activism, and support, we can push back against these injustices across our country and create change. So please take action. Join the ACLU's People Power Volunteer Program by signing up at peoplepower.org. Attend a protest, contact your representatives, make phone calls, and send texts to your neighbors. Give to the ACLU to support the fight. There are so many ways you can participate, and we are stronger when we act together. With your partnership, we will continue the long fight to protect our civil liberties and civil rights. I thank you for staying engaged, resilient, and hopeful. And I am so proud to fight alongside all of you.
I have to give a big thank you to Ariana DeBose for her inspiring message. I feel like I could run 10 miles after listening to her speak, and y'all already know I don't run. So like she said, we are so much stronger when we act together. So I really want to encourage you all to join the ACLU's People Power Volunteer Program at peoplepower.org so you can raise your voice and protect the rights and freedoms today on Election Day and every day after. That's peoplepower.org. Now, as David previewed for us, the First Amendment fared well during this Supreme Court term. Let's turn now to the court's most important free speech decisions, and I'm going to bring back David for this discussion. David, you with me? All right, there we go. I feel like I'm like Steve Kornacki with that. So let's start with the case involving the NRA. So many of our supporters, our allies, maybe even many folks watching right now express confusion, dismay, even anger over the ACLU's defense of the NRA, an organization whose goals, strategies, tactics, I want to be very clear, we vehemently oppose and challenge. David, can you tell us about this case? Why did the ACLU weigh in at all? What does the court's unanimous ruling mean for free speech?
First of all, this is a First Amendment case, not a Second Amendment case. We were defending the NRA because we would defend any organization that was targeted in the way that they were targeted. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York and his chief financial regulator, Maria Vullo, were opposed to the NRA, which is totally fine. But they were not content to speak out against the NRA. They sought to use the regulatory authority they have over banks and insurance companies in New York, which is substantial authority, to coerce those entities into blacklisting the NRA. Why? Not because the NRA did anything illegal, but because they opposed the political viewpoint, namely gun rights, anti-gun control, that the NRA advanced. And in the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit, the court unanimously held that this was perfectly constitutional, that it was okay for government officials to use their regulatory authority to target a political group because of its political views. And at that point, when the Supreme Court took the case, the NRA asked us to represent them, and we did, because we felt this was a critically important precedent, one that would affect not just the NRA, but every political organization in every state. Imagine what Governor DeSantis in Florida would do with this authority to trans rights groups, or what Governor Abbott in Texas would do to immigrants' rights groups, or what many governors in many states might do to the ACLU. Thankfully, we prevailed in the Supreme Court, and we didn't just prevail, we prevailed unanimously with a brilliant decision written by Justice Sotomayor. Underscoring that the principle at stake here was far more important than the politics of the particular group. And this is something the ACLU has been doing since its inception. We defend the principles of free expression regardless of the speaker, because we understand that these principles are critical for all of us.
Thanks for breaking that down, David. I want to reiterate that if the court had allowed New York to blacklist a powerful organization like the NRA, then government officials would be able to blacklist the ACLU and other advocacy organizations fighting for our most vulnerable communities. So, David, there were also two other free speech cases before the court involving social media companies and the government's authority over online speech. So, what do those mean for our rights?
Yeah, so there are really a pair of cases involving whether state legislatures can exercise control over the content of posts on social media platforms. The legislature in Texas and the legislature in Florida determined that they believe large media platforms are biased, and therefore they would impose on those platforms an obligation to be quote unquote viewpoint neutral, to not take down posts because they disagree with their point of view. We supported the platforms in a constitutional challenge to this, and the court again effectively unanimously ruled that social media platforms have First Amendment rights themselves. They are like bookstores or newspapers, and they can make editorial choices over what to publish, what to post, what to offer, based on whether they agree or disagree with the viewpoints. And the state can't come in and say to a bookstore, you must sell books that you disagree with. They can't say to a newspaper, you must publish articles you disagree with. And similarly, the court said, you can't tell a social media platform, it must post. Posts that it disagrees with. So it was a major victory for the First Amendment. And it's coupled with another pair of cases I'll just mention briefly, which involved whether citizens can sue government officials for blocking them from their quote-unquote personal social media platforms when those government officials use those platforms to do government business. And again, the Supreme Court said, yeah, when government officials are using private platforms for public ends, then yes, citizens can sue if they are blocked from those platforms. So all in all, it was a very good term for the First Amendment.
All right. Thank you for walking us through those very important free speech decisions, David. I am going to think beyond the cases that we've discussed, because I know the Supreme Court term was filled with other significant cases that impact our civil liberties. So, David, you stick with us to tell us more. And then, Louise, I'm going to bring you back. See what I'm doing with it? Hey, look at that. Fantastic. So, David, why don't you go ahead and kick us off here?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about two cases. Grants Pass, the case about the rights of the homeless that I referred to in the opening, and then very briefly, State versus Munoz, which was the case about the citizen who was married to an immigrant. So the Grants Pass case involved whether it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment, because it is cruel and unusual, to punish a homeless person for sleeping in public. And a number of lower courts had held yes. And they had relied on a decision from the 1960s from the Supreme Court called Robinson versus California, which ruled that to punish someone for being addicted to drugs is cruel and unusual because it punishes status, not conduct. Now, to be homeless is to have to sleep in public if there's nowhere else to go. And so what the courts below had said was that punishing a homeless person who has nowhere else to go for merely sleeping in public is punishing them for the status of being homeless. And a number of cities were under injunctions to pursue other more efficacious ways to deal with the problem of the homeless and not simply criminalize people for doing something that they have no choice to do. The Supreme Court, 6-3, the same 6-3 reversed and said, no, this is a regulation of conduct, sleeping in public, not status, being homeless, and therefore it's perfectly constitutional. As Justice Sotomayor said in her dissent, sleeping is a biological necessity, not a crime. But now, thanks to the court majority, it can be a crime. The other case that I want to mention really briefly is State versus Munoz, which is similarly cruel in that it says that a U.S. citizen who is married to an immigrant who petitions for that immigrant to have permanent resident status and be with her living here in her country together has no rights whatsoever to challenge a denial of a visa to that individual, even though it means that her husband, the father of her child, cannot live with her in her home country. No rights whatsoever. Years ago, the Supreme Court said professors have a sufficient right in speaking face to face with people at a conference that they can challenge the denial of visa to somebody who is denied the opportunity to come here to speak at that conference. Yet a spouse, in this case, was denied any right whatsoever to challenge a totally unexplained denial of a visa to her husband and the father of her child. Deeply cruel, again, 6-3.
All right, David, thank you so much for that breakdown. Louise, there was also an important case about the gun rights of domestic violence abusers. Can you tell us about that decision?
Sure, so that case is US versus Rahimi. This is a case in which an individual, Zakiya Rahimi, was convicted under a federal law, a section of which forbids individuals who are subject to a domestic violence protection order, that's an order issued by a court, from possessing a firearm. Mr. Rahimi argued that the law violated his Second Amendment rights to bear arms. So the case, when it came to the Court of Appeals, it was in the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, and that court, take a deep breath, it's kind of amazing what it did, but it invalidated the law, saying it found no historical analogs in the 1700s or the 1800s that prohibited those subject to domestic violence protective orders from possessing a firearm. I'll just have to quote one of my colleagues. One of my colleagues has said of this this reasoning, this case, because of that reasoning, threatened to reinvigorate the historical subjugation of women, exploiting a time when women were legally subjugated to men in order to limit our rights today. It's an outrageous opinion. The Supreme Court, however, reversed. The Supreme Court said it did not violate Mr. Rahimi's rights to bar him from having a gun where he'd been subject to a domestic violence protective order. It looked to the history and tradition around gun possession and said there was a history and tradition of taking away guns from people who posed a threat to others. And it also rejected an argument which we urged them to reject. They had been advanced by the US in this case. The US had argued that gun rights extend only to, quote, responsible citizens, close quote. So I just want to make one other point, AJ. I'd just be remiss if I didn't note that the court's approval of the law issue in this case and Rahimi shouldn't foreclose a careful consideration of other gun laws, nor should it foreclose our commitment to explore non-criminal approaches to problems.
Really appreciate you making that distinction, Lise. It's an important one. So now with this term over, I want to make sure that we forecast what lies ahead, because each and every one of these SCOTUS terms have very critical implications for our civil liberties and civil rights. So the Supreme Court has announced that it will hear two cases next term that the ACLU is deeply involved in. Now, David, why don't you tell us what these cases are that we should be looking out for?
Sure. So the first case is called U.S. versus Skirmetti. This is one of the many cases we have filed challenging bans on gender-affirming care that states have imposed in a kind of an anti-trans campaign across the country. And the question presented in the case is whether it violates the Equal Protection Clause to deny medical treatment that a doctor, a parent, and a child have agreed is medically appropriate because the treatment is designed not to conform to the child's sex assigned at birth, but to transition away from the child's sex assigned at birth. Puberty blockers, perfectly permissible in Tennessee if you're seeking to conform to your sex assigned at birth, but not if you're seeking to make a transition. We argue that that's sex discrimination. It's treating people differently based on their sex assigned at birth, and it's enforcing a stereotype, because it is a stereotype that people with a particular sex assigned at birth will live out their lives with that gender identity. We won many of these challenges in the district courts, but we lost in the Sixth Circuit, the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. The Supreme Court has now taken up that case, and it'll be the first case that addresses the equal protection rights of trans people in this country. So a critically important case. The second case is a kind of replay of some cases that the ACLU did some years ago, really challenging the constitutionality of imposing age verification requirements on people getting access to certain kinds of sexual materials online. And the court has twice struck down such laws in a case called ACLU versus Reno and a case called ACLU versus Ashcroft. But Texas, not to be dissuaded by two Supreme Court decisions, passed the same law. And the Fifth Circuit, not to be dissuaded by two Supreme Court opinions, said, well, we actually read the law, the Constitution, better than the Supreme Court, and we're going to uphold these requirements. And so we again petitioned for review before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear those cases, and they're really about whether the state can restrict adults' access to constitutionally protected material online.
All right. Thank you so much for those insights, David. And thank you to Louise as well. Your expertise is invaluable as we make sense of all of these cases. I want to take a quick moment to just shout out our superhero colleagues at the LGBTQ Plus Project, at the ACLU, and so many others who do this work day in and day out that I know takes deep personal sacrifice. So I give you my personal gratitude for that. Now, we are almost at the end of our time together. And so, I think we're going to move us into our final segment. Before I let my colleagues go, I would like to ask our speakers to join me for one final question. And it's something that's been on my mind quite a bit over the last months and frankly years. Because I think as we move forward from this Supreme Court term, I want to know, what's your one call to action for everyone watching? I talk to folks every single day about the work of the ACLU and the work that we all do to defend our civil rights and liberties. And what I feel like I'm hearing more and more from people is fear, anxiety, and often powerlessness. And so people are saying, what can we do? What's the call to action? And so I'm going to start with you, Louise, then go to David, and then Cecilia.
I think the call to action is always vote like your rights depend on it, because they do.
Very well said. David?
So I'll second that. But I would say more broadly, be an engaged citizen in defense of the rights and liberties and values that you believe in. We have a very, very robust constitution only because we have a very robust civil society that consists of people like you coming together in civil society organizations that are aimed at making those rights real, not just words on a page. You know, you look at every other country in the world, they have constitutions that look as good or better than ours, but very few of them actually protect constitutional rights as vigorously as ours. And that's because of organizations like ours, like LDF, like Planned Parenthood. So be an engaged citizen. Yes, vote like your rights depend on it, but also join us in the defense of liberty.
And Cecilia.
My call is to look for the stories and the practices that will keep you resilient in the fights ahead and the ongoing fights. You know, we all have so many worries and concerns, not just about the work that the ACLU does, but about the state of the world and the state of the country beyond the scope of the work. But we have the privilege and the luxury of coming to work every day and channeling those worries and concerns into the work we do day to day. But to keep that going, we need to find the ways that we can inspire ourselves. And I think looking to the examples of freedom fighters now and in the past who've overcome even greater odds and taken greater risks to themselves and their families and overcame those risks and won the battles of the past is one great place to look.
Cecilia, I love that you remind us that unfortunately, we have been here before. Our ancestors have been here before, and we are not alone in continuing to fight for justice and to be on this journey. And so I think the only thing I would add to that, in addition to fighting like your rights depend on it, is also fighting like the rights of others depend on it. Voting like the rights of others depend on it as well. So it's not just about your rights, it's about the rights of people in our communities, people who hold different identities than your own. So vote like other people's rights depend on it.
I love that. Amendment and embraced.
Please. You love that, Louise? Thank you. So my friends, we could not forge this path forward without all of you watching. So I just want to thank you for your support, your commitment, your passion. One of the best ways that we can keep fueling this fight is please by giving to the ACLU. And I actually know that many workplaces will even match donations that are made by their employees. So in that way, you can make sure that your contribution goes even further. And so I really encourage you to look into an employee gift matching program. Take advantage of that today, because it helps your gift go even further as we continue this essential work. So I want to thank again, Louise, David, Cecilia, for having this conversation with me and for all you all do and our colleagues do to protect civil liberties and civil rights every single day. I am deeply proud, as always, to be in the fight with you. And of course, thank you all so much to everyone who joined us today. You are vital partners in this fight. We couldn't do the work without your continued support, your engagement, your activism, and we're deeply grateful for it. So please take the actions that we shared with you today. Urge Congress to pass a constitutional amendment restoring presidential liability at aclu.org/no kings. We elect presidents in this country, no kings. Sign up at peoplepower.org to become an ACLU volunteer. peoplepower.org, we need y'all on the ground. And take advantage of your employer's gift matching program. Please always continue to raise your voice. It is more powerful than you know, especially right now. So we look forward to keeping you engaged in the work ahead. Take good care of yourself, my friends, and please take very good care of each other.